Well, good morning, church.
You know, each week I'm so excited. It's a great time to be a part of the Forest Mill family, and each week it seems like I just see a new face or two that I haven't either seen in a while or haven't gotten to speak with in a while. And each week it seems like we get a few more people back and kind of back into rotation, into circulation, and into being a part of our Sunday morning time together. So thankful for that and thankful for your presence, whether you are here with us in person or you're still at home online. We're thankful for your presence as well. It is Father's Day, and it's been mentioned already. I know it's a great day. I do have an obligatory Father's Day joke, but it's kind of a little bit heretical. So I'm going to tell it, but just know this is not my view of Jesus, but I got to tell it anyway. So Jesus is sitting around in heaven, and he looks over and he sees a guy. He's like, boy, that guy looks familiar. So Jesus, this is not a true story, right? Because Jesus already knows everybody. So Jesus looks over and sees a guy. He's like, well, he looks really familiar. I think that might be Joseph, my father. So he goes over to this older man, and he says, excuse me, sir, but you look so familiar. Did you have a son? The old man said, well, yes, I did, but he wasn't my biological son, but I raised him as my own, and I loved him. And Jesus says, oh, wow, that's great. Did your son face temptation? And the old man says, yes, he did face temptation, struggled mightily, but he overcame. And Jesus says, that's amazing. The man goes on to say, but he was ultimately killed and then miraculously was brought back to life, an even bigger, fuller life, more than ever before by this miraculous power from above. And Jesus says, he kind of rubs his eyes. He looks at the old man and he says, Father? And the old man rubs his eyes and says, Pinocchio? It's my Father's Day joke. All right, so happy Father's Day. Not a true story, but I love the joke. All right, so there was this article. It was called Super Spectators, written in USA Today, and these sports writers went out and they tried to find sports fanatics to describe the lengths to which they would go to support their teams. And one of the categories that they look at, they call it the frequent flyer category. And this is just a few examples from the frequent flyer category of the sports fanatics. Mike Pratt, who lives in Louisville, Kentucky, has been flying his Cessna, a little small airplane, right, to watch every home game for the last 7 years of the Detroit Lions. According to the article, Pratt doubles down on weekends where his alma mater, Michigan State, is also playing and flies the extra 45 minutes to East Lansing on Saturdays. And then you have a guy like Frank Weishaupt, and when he was 11, he wrote to the New York Jets to get on their season ticket holder list, and he waited 8 years to get those tickets. And so for each home game, Frank flies out of San Francisco to Boston and then drives the 3.5 hours up to Kingston to watch the Jets. 2007, Donna Eggenhofer, she's an Orlando resident, and she made every Indianapolis Colts home game. Lou Rossetti leaves New Jersey on Friday night, takes a vacation day on Mondays to make every Dallas Cowboys home game. And this guy, he's a truck driver. He admits it's just like, you know, an expensive trip. And he says it's just barely affordable. And this says Rossetti, he said, I started when I was single. I got married. I continued it. And now I'm divorced. It survived all of that, and I managed to find the money and time to go. I thought that was pretty telling. Because sold-out people will do just about anything for what they truly love. Imagine if you had tickets to your favorite team, whatever that may be, basketball, football, baseball, soccer. If there's nobody really likes soccer, but you know, whatever sport it is that you love. Just kidding. Over here. Whatever your favorite sport is. Imagine you had like tickets to the big game, whether it's a World Cup match or the Super Bowl or the World Series or the NBA Finals or whatever it is you're really into. Imagine the lengths, if your team was playing in that big game, the lengths to which you would go, right? But if you really love that team or that sport or that event, right, you'd be willing to take the weekend off at the very least, to get a hotel room or a rental car or the tickets, the air traffic tickets, the airplane tickets, right? Because sold out people will do just about anything for what they value. So last week we began this talking about in Jesus, this part of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, talking about what we really value and where we look for security, because security is something we hold in really high value. And specifically, Jesus talked about treasures. We talked about, Jesus said, don't treasure your treasures, right? Don't look to your treasures for security, because valuing our treasure has a way of unfocusing our hearts. And Jesus says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also, Matthew 6:21. Because the heart is not just love, and it is love, but it's our focus, it's our will, it's our spirit, it's what we dwell on, it's what we think about, it's what we hope for. And so when Jesus says, don't let your heart be focused on your treasures, it's the center of our being from which life flows. So a heart rightly directed brings health and wholeness and completion, and a heart wrongly directed brings disaster. And that's what Jesus talks about here. And he compares our heart sight to eyesight. And this is what he says in Matthew 6:22-23. It says, the eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? Now, at first glance, as you're reading through, at least for me, as I was reading through this part of the Sermon on the Mount, I thought, what is he talking about here? What does this have to do with the treasures that he was just talking about before and what we talked about last week? And so it seems like this passage on heart sight, we'll call it, is out of place. But let's dig in a little bit and try to explain. Think about our eyesight, which Jesus compared it to, how the eyesight affects the body. He said, when the eyes are healthy, the body's full of light, right? Like this morning, somebody thought that I was getting way too much light on this face, and like, nobody wants to see that. Or maybe I'm getting more and more bald, and the glare was part of the problem with the cameras back there. I don't know. But there's still plenty of light in here. You can see, you know, pretty well everything. You can see where the chairs are, where people are seated. Yeah, you could go find your communion supplies easily or make your way to the restrooms or the kitchen, whatever it need to be. There's plenty of light for you to be able to do that, right? Because the light comes in through your eyes to your body, and it's like your body now has the ability to move rightly because the eyes are working correctly. So I can walk where I need to walk. I can put my hands where I need to put my hands. I can turn where I need to turn, all because the light is coming into my body. The rest of the body will work because the light is coming in through my eyes. And so if your eye works, it takes that light in and allows the rest of your body to function. I saw that. And so the person who treasures what lies in the kingdom sees everything for its true worth, sees everything in proper relationship. It's like the eyes are working. I see the chair where the chair actually is. I have enough light to move through the world. I don't have a distorted vision, right? I can move and function. By contrast, though, the person who treasures what's on earth, that person ends up with a really distorted vision. And it misleads in practice because of the relative importance of things are misunderstood. It would be like if I said, okay, I'm going to make my way across here, but I see there's these lines in this floor here. Now, with a right perspective, I understand, oh, that's just a little tiny crack, and I can step right on that or right over that, and it's no big deal. But imagine if my perspective was completely thrown off, and I think it's a deep and wide crevasse, and I can't step over these little cracks. I can't make my way across this room. All of a sudden, I'm isolated here, right? All because my vision is wrong. I have a wrong perspective, a wrong understanding of reality. So if your eyes aren't working, even though there is light around your body, it's just like you're stuck in darkness because you can't function. An extreme example of what Jesus is talking here might be, let's just say an addiction, any addiction. Because when you have an addiction, everything else in the world is seen in relationship to that addiction. Will this activity help me continue that addiction, or is it going to be a barrier to that addiction? Will this relationship further my addiction, or is it going to prevent me from continuing my activity, right? Everything is overshadowed by that one thing, and so the whole rest of the world gets distorted. That's why people who are struggling with addiction, you know, their most valuable relationships are just warped and messed up, and they end up in close relationships with really other broken people more than the people who really love them. And they can't function in a job or hang on to money or have any possessions. Everything else just falls by the wayside because that one thing distorts the whole rest of the view. It darkens your eye spiritually. So what Jesus is talking about here is really greed. And greed is nothing more than an addiction to stuff, to material things. But here's why greed is particularly dangerous. Jesus calls it an eye sin, right? It's because you see it and you want it. But it darkens your spiritual vision. It's different than other sins because Jesus didn't have to say, like, watch out, you might be committing adultery. You're like, oh, wow, I did not know I was committing adultery. I thought this was my wife. Right? If you're committing adultery, you know you're committing adultery. Jesus didn't say, watch out, you might be murdering someone. No, if you are murdering someone, hopefully you are mentally well enough to understand I am murdering or have murdered someone. He didn't have to say watch out for those things because if you do them, you know it. The thing about greed is it darkens your eyes and limits your vision to the extent because it hides itself. It blinds you in a way that other sins do not. It is so difficult to know when you are being greedy. Jesus is saying, we don't really ever consider the possibility that we might be greedy. We know we do wrong stuff, right? I know when I do some things that are selfish or when I do some things that are mean-spirited, or I know when I say things that are ugly or I think things that are wrong. I know when I do and act in ways that are not right. I generally know that, but we don't ever think, boy, I'm just really being greedy. That is such a rare thought. Instead, this is what we do. Instead, we go, who's greedy? Who's greedy? Oh, those rich people, right? The people who live in the next subdivision over, or my next door neighbors, or who live across town, or the people who live in New York City, or Los Angeles, or maybe it's just people who are CEOs or people who are actors or whatever. Those are the people who are greedy. Maybe you even have, like, you're thinking of a a relative you have who likes to spend more extravagantly. Those are the greedy people, right? And that is all it takes. All it takes for you not to be greedy is to think of someone else who is. If I can think of someone who, whether it's someone I know in person or someone I've seen on TV or heard on the radio or read about, if I can just think of somebody else who's greedy, that person's way more. I'm not really greedy. That person is greedy. And we don't even consider the possibility that maybe we're being materialistic too. Which brings us to what Jesus says next. He says, no one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. We talked about last week our treasures and the place they have in our life. And what Jesus is saying is, whatever it is you treasure, you cannot help but be devoted to that treasure, right? We will serve our treasures. Whatever your treasure is, you are going to serve that treasure. We will work for them and during the day and think about them at night. We'll dream about them. We'll talk about them to other people. But it is not uncommon for people to think that they can treasure more than one thing. That they can treasure something in this world and God stuff. I'm going to treasure this and God. And sometimes we can make that work for a little while. It will go along well enough that we can function that way. But there inevitably comes a time where one master has to give way to the other, because you cannot have two ultimate goals. We can't be both a servant of God and a servant of things on earth, because those requirements will ultimately conflict. If the most important thing to you is to have a certain house or a certain bank account or drive a certain car or wear certain clothes or send your kids to certain schools, whatever it is that's your materialistic goal, if that is your ultimate goal, ultimately achieving that goal is going to conflict with God's goals for your life. Because attachment to money, Jesus says it's a rival for God. And he doesn't even use the word money here. He uses the word mammon. It's like the proper name that refers to a rival God. Jesus views money as something that tries to rival God for preeminence, for most important status. And attachment to that money therefore leads to detachment from God. Attachment to money leads to detachment from God. Money fights for supremacy of our lives. And it has a lot of the characteristics of a God, because money promises security and freedom and power. Yeah. Money promises security and freedom and power, which is exactly what a God would promise. For example, unless you have already put God first, then what you'll do to be financially secure is wide open. What you will do to impress other people, that's wide open, or fulfill your desires, and that is going to invariably lead you against God's will. That's why the very first of the Ten Commandments is, you shall have no other gods before me. I happen to share a birthday with celebrity hip-hop icon Mary J. Blige, which people get us confused all the time. You probably have heard of her if you're under a certain age, and probably have not heard of her if you listen to different genres, right? But she was asked the following question. She was in an interview, and they said, Mary, you're a devout Christian, and so how do you reconcile bling with God? And let's just take a time out. For those of you who are unfamiliar, bling is referring to extravagant clothing or jewelry or outfits or a lifestyle that's grandiose, maybe. So they said, how do you reconcile your bling with your devotion to God? And so she says, and this is her response, my God is a God who wants me to have things. He wants me to bling. He wants me to be the hottest thing on the block. I don't know what kind of God the rest of y'all are serving, but the God I serve says, Mary, you need to be the hottest thing this year, and I'm going to make sure you're doing that. My God is the bomb. This is not a new interview, kids, but it was a few years ago. That was her exact quote. And so on the surface, we're probably like, oh, that's just shocking. I cannot believe someone who claims to be a Christian would say something like that. But what Mary J. Blige has done is just put a face on the God that many Christians serve. I'm not trying to out her and say that she's any worse or better than the rest of us. I'm just saying she has put a face to the God that many of us serve. The problem is that we want to be a saint, but we also want to experience every sensation experienced by sinners. We want to be innocent and pure, but we also want to experience and taste all of life. We want to serve the poor and have a simple lifestyle, but we also want all the comforts of the rich. We want to have the depth that is afforded to us by solitude with God, but we also don't want to miss anything. We want to pray, but we also want to watch TV and go out to eat and take an amazing vacation. And we can really struggle with a divided heart. We struggle with our allegiances. And so the point that Jesus is making is that a kingdom heart cannot be divided. Either we will look to God for our ultimate security, or we will look to money for our security. But we cannot look to both. Professor Addison Leach, he knew a couple of young women. They wanted to be, they were the Christian young women. They wanted to become missionaries. And so they went to their parents and they said, we've become Christians and we want to become missionaries. And each of their parents says, oh, that's great. You had a religious experience. How wonderful, but you're going to need some security. So before you go off on your missionary experience, which is fine, we want you to have at least a master's degree. We want you to have gotten a job or two, and so you've gotten your career off the ground before you do this, and then you have some money in the bank for some security. So if you want to go be a missionary, that's fine, but you got to do these other things first. So these girls come back to Dr. Leach and said, what do we do about that? What do we say to that? Because, I mean, I don't know how to combat my... Here's what you say to your parents. Tell them that you are on a little rock, a ball of a rock that is spinning through space, and it's called Earth. And who knows, we're going to run into something. But even if we don't, someday every one of us is going to fall through a trap door and fall off the very edge. And underneath us, when we fall through this trap door, is either going to be the everlasting arms of God or it's going to be nothing. And you think that a master's degree is going to give you security. Crumbling financial giants have devastated many people, but they have done nothing to emphasize the futility of looking to them for security. How many people that were rock solid sure in certain stocks or certain companies or certain financial investments have lost everything? Because there is no such thing as a guarantee. There is no bank, no vault, no investment, no government. It's invincible. So the question we have to ask ourselves this week is where are we looking for security? Where are we looking for our security? Because if we believe for even a portion of it that our security is found in our wallets or in what we have in the parking lot or what we have at the end of our driveway, And we are sadly and sorely mistaken. And that's what Jesus is telling us here in his Sermon on the Mount, that we cannot have a divided kingdom heart, that either we'll be loyal to God or we will be loyal to seeking that security through materialistic things, but we cannot be both. And if you have been struggling with divided allegiances and you are ready to pledge your allegiance to God and to God alone this morning, and if you need prayers of encouragement, or if you're ready to become a child of the only God who can lead you, care for you, provide for you, and give you the security you need, we want to help you with that this morning. Won't you come as we stand and as we sing?